This is X-Formation, brought to you by the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. I'm Will, and today, as always, I am joined by my colleague, Caden. Caden,
hey, Will.
How's it going?
It's going all right. Listen, I don't know if you've heard, there's a chip shortage. You know this.
Everyone's talking about this. Everyone has been having this conversation. So yes, let's get into this.
Everyone but me, apparently.
Yeah.
No, I say that. I'm a little coy. I had this explained to me at a car dealership because a couple weeks ago, I was driving my car and I caught a flat tire picking up my parents from the airport. And we just took it straight there. I have roadside hazard, whatever, on my tires.
So do you have those run flats, by the way?
I do.
And
you want to get the insurance because that's not fun to pay.
Because that stuff is like super expensive, right?
It is the first time. And I had a few other things going on with the car. And so I took it and I said, hey, warranty, like fix it, please. Uh-huh. And I said, hey, by the way, I've got these clients in town. My parents. I've got these clients in town and I need a loaner. And he just looks at me and goes, I don't know if you know this, but there's a chip shortage. And we don't have any cars in the lot. And he points to the lot and it's like almost barren empty. There are no cars out there. And I just didn't notice. And I immediately was embarrassed because I knew there was a chip shortage. I just had never put it into, into perspective. Like I don't play I don't play PlayStation, so I didn't get a PS5. I haven't gotten a new computer recently. Nothing that I've been doing has needed chips. I've had them whatever I needed.
Yeah.
And then it all came home. And I thought to myself, oh, goodness, there's something
I need to
research.
When it affects you, then you start caring.
So I've spent the last week or so looking into this chip shortage.
Yes.
Because I was so embarrassed.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know this or anyone else knows this, but chips are actually just made out of sand.
Yeah, right. So
I want to get into this.
So you finally, like, I remember when I did like the deep dive into microchips, right? And just like in semiconductors and all of this, like going back into the history. Yeah. So you've been on that journey, which I'm glad for.
It's a fun journey.
Yeah. Because for people who aren't like super technical and even people who are like programmers, there's no necessary reason why you would even, like, unless you got a formal education in it, right? You would know about chip design. But for the most part, if like even in a lot of other cases, you're still never going to get kind of like the whole backstory, the whole like.
You certainly never learn it in an economics class or an accounting class or in a legal class. You learn it from a YouTube video that explains how it's made, right?
Yes.
And you learn it from a bunch of them to make sure that you're right. But essentially, silicon, which is the thing that goes into chips, right? Like the little wafers, the whole the plasticky thing.
Yeah.
That's just sand, which sand is silicon dioxide, silicon oxide. Not sure which one.
Silicon dioxide. Yeah.
There's a reason why chemistry was so hard. Anyway, it's made out of sand, which is
very pure silicon, right?
Silicon is one of the second most abundant resources on the planet, which makes sense why we're using it for microchips. But
now that is something I didn't know. I didn't realize
it was. Because the wafer that a chip is actually put on is a semiconductor. That's the semiconductor. Mm-hmm. And it is able to conduct electricity or be an insulator. What this means basically is instead of having to use wires or little metal bits, you use silicon and you can transfer the electricity throughout it by putting in impurities into the thing. It's basically a crazy little lab experiment project of how you make a semiconductor chip. And it all comes down to sand, which I thought was super, super interesting. But I also was watching this video, one of many, and they've got these crazy suits on. They've got everything covered, their mouths, their hair, everything. And you have to figure out what a clean room is. Do you know what a clean room is?
I do know what a clean room is. Yeah. So before clean rooms, their chips themselves, people really, really, really like there was a lot of problems. So before, I was actually reading about the invention of the clean room, however long ago, when this entire semiconductor industry first started, right? When Silicon Valley actually started in a major way from what's the name of the group, like the Traitorous Six or whatever the group is, the people who left HP, I think it was not HP, the anyway, well we'll put this in the show notes, But at the very, very beginning of this history, there was a design. There was a whole bunch of people who were designing these chips early on. And what they found is that as things got smaller and smaller, as things right. got more complicated, the actual impurities started showing up. So it started being a lot more important as your chips became more technically advanced. Yeah. And so the clean room itself was kind of like this problem solver, right? By having mm-hmm. something in a lab setting, and really that's how it started. People started working in lab settings. Then they realized, oh, wait a second, all of those little impurities, all the little pieces of dust are mm-hmm. actually super, super, super important whenever you're manufacturing this chip.
So one of the things that really stuck out to me was that in these clean rooms, you can't have dust that is larger than 0.5 nanometers per 10 liters of air. And I looked this up. 0.5 nanometers is basically the smallest coronavirus particle, like the invisible enemy. If it's even that big, that's too much. These clean rooms are basically little quarantine centers, and not dust. I mean, I saw them clicking on their mouses. The mouses are super clean. I was really impressed by that. Everything is very controlled. And when they use their microscopes, they put up a human hair to a microchip, and the microchip was smaller than the human hair, which was crazy. But then that gets into how hard these chips are to make and how fast they're progressing. What law is it? Which one's the one that is like it'll go 2 times smaller every 2 years? Something.
Oh, yeah. Moore's law. Yeah.
So Moore's law is a big driver in the chip industry. And right now, there are, give or take, 2 or 3 big chip manufacturers that are still able to keep up with the supply and the demand. But that's not really what's important today. That's all the science. I wanted to get the science out because I spent way too much time looking into it, and I thought it was really interesting. But I got to know, Will, what happened to all the chips?
Yes. By the way, real short thing. I just had to have the reminder. I should have even looked this up beforehand, right? But the original group, Moore, was one of the most important people because he helped to start Fairchild, and this was the first semiconductor. Wow. So, you know, Moore's law was Gordon mm-hmm. Moore. And they left Shockley Semiconductor. So it was Moore, Shockley, and all those people basically left Bell Labs and started and created all these in the 1950s. I mean, yeah, integrated circuits, all this is super, super, super important, obviously.
Transistors,
so
said transistors, more jargon.
Even more
terms
jargon,
that almost nobody knows what they are, including me.
What
happened to all the chips? What happened here?
I mean, this to me was a really, really interesting sort of thing, right? So there's this, you know, as you even point out, there's this like supply and demand question, right? There's this very, very clear supply and demand issue. And really what I think is kind of fascinating with all of this is that at the very, very beginning of COVID, right? So there's kind of like two events happening, right? You have the very, very beginning of COVID, you have all, or at least a lot of the chip manufacturers and a lot of the people who are working in, you know, in the tech industry and mm-hmm. kind of all the supply chains, they start cutting their deals, right? They basically start pulling back on the deals that they had, or at least were going to buy certain kinds of products with the mm-hmm. expectation that COVID itself was going to create a massive downturn. Well,
right.
This is what
it was going to crash the economy, right?
Companies pulled back on their orders, right? So mm-hmm. they pulled back on their orders for chips.
Yeah.
Well, what happened? Then you had this massive surge in all of these technologies at the same time that needed chips. And so mm-hmm. this is actually what's really, really fascinating to me because, you know, as economists, we're really taught about these events, you know, kind of demand shock or supply shock. A demand shock, you don't really ever see demand shock in any meaningful way. But this mm-hmm. that's exactly what happened here, right? There was this kind of like pullback in demand by the large manufacturers, you know, the kind of the supply inputs. And then they then came back, you know, 6 months later, and then they started demanding things even more because a whole bunch of new orders started coming in, right? So what's surprising is, and what's important, right? The fact that we know that it's demand shocked is because of this exact problem that all of these companies expected they were going to have lower supply, and yet that didn't happen. Right? They expected lower supply. They cut their agreements, and then we had even bigger demand than what people expected.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we had PlayStation 5 get released, right?
Yeah.
More people were buying cars for reasons that auto manufacturers were not expecting. Yep.
People needed computers, right?
Data centers went up, right? Yep. Like Zoom calls, you gotta put those through a server somewhere.
More iPads were needed, yep. So more like the people started upgrading their devices if they hadn't done it in quite some time, because there was a lot more consumer money. So like there was a lot more consumer expenditures that went up, or that's a little complicated, but needless to say, there's been a huge shift in demand for these sorts of products.
Yeah, there was just a big technological buying surge, which in hindsight was obvious, right? But
yes,
at the time, when you're thinking about the fact that the economy was crashing, or it looked to be crashing, right? People don't buy consumer electronics when the economy is crashing.
Exactly.
Right. So that was the thought.
But this was different because this is when we did buy consumer electronics.
Exactly. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So that's one part of where the chips went.
Yes.
But that's not where all the chips went. And this is the part that we got into disagreement with earlier, and I had to put an end to it because I wanted to do it live. And I suspect that I just have a wrong interpretation of what's happened, because I'm not an economist. But I wanted to ask the questions live because I think they're important. I think that they're questions that people have that aren't being answered. One of the questions is, why can't we just make more chips? And obviously, we explained the science earlier. That was really exciting. Yes. Isn't there other stuff, though? Well, there's more to this than just simply it comes out of sand and you have to put it through a lab.
Well, I mean, yes, obviously there are, right? And it's because this is still a very advanced, like, high technology space that is like advanced manufacturing, right? So so in that really important sense, it's not easy to produce these chips. So that is part of it, right? There's a lot of demand, and these are very technical factories that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, you know, the United States, for various reasons, which I think we're going to get into, is that America and American companies have generally outsourced a lot of that supply to other companies or to other like supply manufacturers, which kind of makes sense, because what's happened is that, say, you're, you know, and Apple, I think, is kind of an odd choice to even be considering. But when you're talking about most other computer manufacturers, what they're really, really focused on is creating the package, the bundle, right? Or at least traditionally, they were really focused on creating the package or the bundle as it sits all together. So instead of making a semiconductor in-house, you buy a semiconductor, you buy the memory, right? And you buy the hard drive, and you package that all together. You call that a computer, and then you sell it to a consumer. Right. Because it doesn't make sense to do a lot of this stuff in-house, because one, it's pretty expensive to make it. Mm-hmm. And two, you know, there have been, I mean, we can kind of get into this, but there's like these very kind of deep technological supply lines in other countries. In particular, in South Korea has a big one, you know, Samsung. Yeah. There is some manufacturing in America. Like, don't get it wrong. Like, there's still actually, I think it,
we still I got found, Intel, I think.
Yeah, Intel. There's a huge contingent in Texas. Uh-huh. We produce about 12%, I think I saw most recently, 12% of all chips in the world. So it's not as though we can't do this. It's just that the supply chains are not that deep in the United States as compared to other countries. In particular, China, Malaysia has a big contingent. Vietnam has another big contingent. And then South Korea has a big contingent. And Japan as well. And a lot of this also matters a lot which space you're talking about, right? So in part, there are different chip manufacturers for different supply lines. And in fact, this is one of the big problems and one of the big reasons.
Computers versus cars versus
exactly. So the iPads. the cars problem is a very, very interesting one, because there really only is one supplier, a Japanese supplier, from my understanding. Yeah. And that the supplier actually had a fire beginning of last year. And so a whole bunch of the advanced, you know, the machinery basically melted, and they've been only slowly getting back into ramping up their supply. And so
there's very few suppliers of the equipment to build that back up too, right?
Exactly.
Very few, right? There's like three total people who can, or companies that can make the specific equipment to make the chips.
Yep.
That was also pretty fascinating. I mean, if you're thinking about ramping up production really quickly, you think about building out and buying lots of equipment. But if there's not even equipment to buy, you've got a bottleneck.
Yes. You have a bottleneck now, right?
Yeah.
Well, no, but you have a bottleneck now because you're only testing the supply chain. So now, so this is the other part. So this is why we didn't get into it, you know, beforehand, because I wanted to get into it now, which is that, so you're right. There, what is it? ASML is this company that is the major supplier of all the equipment for these companies to produce the chips, right?
They're based out of the Netherlands.
Based out of the Netherlands, right? Which is interesting as well, because there's, again, a lot of this, I think, comes down to supply chains, but they're the only, they're the major output, the major producer for all of the tools to go into the input, right? Mm-hmm. So they're like they're upstream to the chip manufacturers.
Yeah.
Well, this has never really been tested before. I mean, ASML is now doing well as a company, primarily because of this, right? Because now you have a diversified portfolio of chip manufacturers. There's desire to have more chip manufacturers. That for the longest time there were a limited amount of chip manufacturers, right? So it's like you're having different kinds of markets that are being tested all at the same time, right? So you have the chip space is itself being tested, and so you have companies that are diversifying for, you know, for various risks, right? And and in part some of that's, you know, related to international issues. There's worries in the United States that, you know, especially post COVID, that certain chips or chip manufacturers, you know, shut down for a certain amount of time, and that, you know, why not just have everything integrated in one country or at least a couple different countries, because there's such a supply chain risk when it comes to chips themselves. So there's that sort of demand, right? There's a demand for new chip manufacturers, new chip inputs. Well, then that has a follow on effect to the manufacturers of those inputs, and so a company like ASML is now doing well because now there's interest in diversifying the total portfolio of factories of chip manufacturers.
So if I can put that in another way, there are
that's really esoteric.
There are a lot more companies who need the equipment to build the chips in a lot of different ways.
Exactly. But when you have a demand shock, the demand shock ripples through the entire supply chain. So it's not just the chip manufacturers that are impacted, but it's the manufacturers of the chip manufacturers' inputs.
Of the equipment.
So you would expect that probably that all of those inputs that go into their process as well is probably that they're probably facing problems.
Yeah. So they've got to be maxed out.
Yeah. Yeah. Which of course is the issue that we're talking about here, right? Is that it's not easy when you have this sort of really big demand shock, it's not easy to quickly supply. I mean, things are getting better over time, right? A lot of these things are easing. From my understanding, this is basically the peak of the market, right? Right now is the total peak of the problem of the chip shortage just writ large.
Right. Well, from that, then what do we do going forward, right? Like it's really hard to just make more supply to fix the short-term problem.
Yep.
But long-term, there are at least some efforts in the U.S. to correct this, to bring back home, to repatriate our chip manufacturing.
Yeah, repatriate supply chains. Yeah, so part of this came from, I mean, this is something that's been talked about at least a large part of this year, especially as this kind of ramped up. This is really in February that this started ramping up. This is part of the Endless Frontiers Act, which now has a less cool name. It's called United States Innovation and Competition Act.
What's not cool about that?
I mean, that's lame, man.
I think it's lame. That's
Endless Frontier. Pretty great. That's pretty good. You have to respect that. You have to respect good copy. Anyway,
USICA. That's a cool acronym.
I forget what people are saying. There is a name for it, but whatever. we're gonna step aside that. Right.
Tell me what's in this.
So what's included in this is this portion called the Chips for America Act, which is going to be the name of this episode. And the Chips for America Act is basically $52 billion to bring stuff into the United States, is to bring factories into the United States. So it's right. It's just
And high-tech factories, right?
Yeah.
this is what Eli mentioned on another podcast, not on our Xformation podcast, but another one, that we should be doing more high tech factories.
Yes. Right?
Bringing that in.
So that's, I mean, I think that the only real way to do this is going to be if they kind of build out the current supply chain spaces, right? There's only certain areas. And this is what I think that I worry a lot about this, and, you know, thinking about, is this a good or a bad bill? Or even if it's a good or a bad idea, my worry is that money will be spent instead. I mean, since we're going to be spending, if we're going to be spending $52 billion on this, what we should be doing is basically spending most of that money in the spaces that already have chip manufacturing, right? The only real way to do it's going to be mostly, from my understanding, it's mostly located in Austin. There's a big contingent in Austin, Texas. There's another big contingent in Washington. Huh? Yeah, I mean, it would. It's going to have a boon for Texas. And there's another big contingent in Washington, around the Seattle area, from my understanding, but I could be wrong about that. I should look and see if there's other major areas. But those are from my understanding, those are the two big ones that have a lot of the chip manufacturing. And obviously, there's stuff in Silicon Valley, but that goes without saying. But basically, you need to spend money in those spaces, in those areas, because what you need to build out are the supply chains within that area. For better or worse, that's what you've got to do.
You don't just mean the manufacturing supply chains. You also mean like equipment supply chains.
Yes, because it all needs to be processed. It all has to be based. I mean, the reason why Silicon Valley is where it is because they all co-located in the same area to produce effectively similar products. Right. Yeah. So the only way to really build out
first.
Yes. But I mean, there are at least. So they were supplied. They did supply the military. Mm-hmm. That is very, very true. But so did traditionally, what is it, Route 128 in Boston area. So they also were another major supplier. The classic story about this, if you want to read a book about this, is Regional Advantage by Annalee Saxion. It's like one of the best books on economic history and supply chain management, really. I mean, it's a great book about all these issues.
We're going to put it in the show notes for sure.
We will definitely put that book in the show notes.
Back to the $52 billion. Sorry.
But point being, but this brings about what I think is my big worry, is that if you're going to spend this money, it needs to be spent in the kind of agglomerated economies that already exist in this space, right? Mm-hmm. There's only certain areas that are doing chip manufacturing or that could sustain chip manufacturing in the near future. We probably just need to help, or at least try to create advanced manufacturing in those areas instead of somewhere I don't want to say in the middle of America, because that's where I'm from and that's where you're from as well. But they need to be connected to an area of high technology. And that really is a very key, important part of this. And that's not, from my experience and from my understanding, that kind of demand for a local production and a local market and kind of deepen very local supply chains is not part of this Endless Frontiers, specifically the Chips for America bill.
Well, that's an important point, right? If you're closer to a technological center like Silicon Valley, you have more access to engineers, because that's where they go to get the cool jobs, right? That's where the best talent goes. So that's actually a very important point.
But that also produces ancillary talent to support that talent as well, right?
Yeah.
So that's where you really do need to, if you're going to be doing this, you really do need to do it in the places that effectively already have that manufacturing, instead of somewhere that is just, you know, that is not connected to the larger supply chain or the economy in that regards. And I'm sure there's a lot of different places you could probably put these factories.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know. I mean, I worry about this problem. When we saw it back in the 90s, which there was a whole bunch of money spent on, you know, on these science parks that were connected to universities, which didn't have that big of a benefit, primarily because they weren't really connected to a larger ecosystem that could supply them with the kind of knowledge that were required to maintain and sustain those types of markets.
Yeah.
Now that goes without saying. So the one thing, at least I think probably that, you know, we should probably end this, is there have been some companies and you brought this up as well.
I really wanted to end this pretty strong by getting back to the cars.
Yes.
Because I went like a week without a car. My car was severely messed up.
I remember you were kind of cranky. You were a little
cranky. I did not like Ubering. You love your car, right? I spent way more money transporting than I normally would have, and that was a little annoying. But I also wanted to get back to cars, because back in 2011, Toyota had a similar problem, not with chips, but with paint, with a pigment of paint, right? And
yeah, this is fascinating. I didn't realize that was the issue, but there was
this nuclear disaster at Fukushima in 2011. Yep. And basically their ability to have this paint was just like wiped out, and they didn't have enough because car manufacturers typically use a first-in-time supply system. And FIFO LIFO is just ingrained in me. anyway, so what they learned from this was that it's sometimes a good idea to stockpile, right? Stockpile supplies.
Yeah.
And since then, the chip shortage hasn't affected Toyota, right? Because they knew that they needed to have a stockpile of parts to build their cars just in case.
Yeah.
Because they know that you go from just in time to just in case.
Exactly.
And
right.
I'm thinking that's a lesson to be learned for all car manufacturers or computer parts manufacturers or Apple or Samsung.
I mean, and that's the other part of this Endless Frontiers Chips for America Act that I think is really interesting as well, right? That effectively companies already are signaled, or at least have the signal, you know, you need to diversify your supply chains. And that's pretty clear. Everyone's doing this. You know, in part, you can kind of see what Apple's even doing with their merging. I mean, it's slightly different when they're creating their own, Apple tech and their Apple semiconductors. I mean, it's it's for their other reasons as well. But but largely, you're seeing companies, you know, they're getting the message. The message is that there are a lot of risks with these supply chains. Countries like China have had problems in the past, and you know, especially in something that is considered and understood to be a very important technological linchpin in all industries. China is doing a very, very clear job of trying to build these semiconductors within their space. Europe is doing this as well. Yeah. So I guess the bigger point is that I think that effectively, I mean, companies are already getting this idea, and I think countries are getting this idea as well, that there needs to be supply chain repatriation. Not necessarily has to be supply chain repatriation, right? Mm-hmm. But companies are repatriating supply chains, bringing them back into their kind of their countries of origin, because there is a lot of risk that's involved if they aren't located in that same space.
Yeah.
And it's that understanding the risk of a new world to me is something that we're still adjusting to. It is kind of a fascinating problem to watch kind of go through as we're, you know, as it's happening right now. There's going to be a really, really, really great book about this, right? And then about the lessons to be understood from this specific issue. So,
Well, I guess that answers my question. What happened to the chips?
There we go. As always, rate, like, subscribe, and be well.